Today and tomorrow, we're going to talk about theories and models for HCI. And so what I want to do here is to give you a sort of overview of a number of theories and models in various aspects of HCI that I think are relevant. On the human side, with perception, action, cognition, and behavior. On the interaction side itself, and then on the software engineering side. And before we do that, since the title was Theories and Model, I want to explain a little bit what is a theory and what is a model. Because these are words, especially the word model, in computer science is used a lot. And in fact, some people even say that, you know, computer science is the science of modeling things, so you can sort of simulate them, for example. So what is a model? A model is a simplification, the way I define it, it's a simplification of reality. Reality is complex. If I want to create I don't know, if I want to create a system to model what is in this room, you know, what is it I want to describe? I mean, do I want to go to the level of each individual hair on each of your heads? Do I want to just have the shape and know who is sitting in what place? So depending on what I want to do, I want to describe the world in a more or less precise way, or decide that some things are important and some are not. So it is in that sense that it's an abstraction of reality. Abstraction means removing, right? So I remove stuff, I omit details that are non-relevant to make things simple so I can deal with them. And the goal is to be useful for a particular problem. So if you take the same world or phenomenon or situation, depending on what you want to do about it, different models will be useful. Now, since we are removing stuff, since we are abstracting out, since we are omitting details, there is a conflict between precision and generality. If I have a model that is more precise, it's going to be more complex, more difficult to deal with, but it will be closer to reality, and but also more specific to that particular situation. If I abstract out a lot, I have a more general model, and maybe it's easier to deal with, but maybe, and it's more general, it can say, well, you know, a model of this room is there is stuff in the room, and I don't need, for example, to know what the things are. So if I go to a more general model, I gain some qualities, but I lose something else. So this is in itself very abstract, I realize. So why do we create models? Well, we can create models for three different types of things in HCI. I think a model is interesting if it has some descriptive capability, if it allows me to represent some aspects of a phenomenon. In a sense, that's sort of the core of every model, is to describe something relevant to the real world. So we expect a model to have some descriptive power. Now, a model that would be able to describe anything and everything would probably not be very useful. It would be so general so as not to be very useful. So it's interesting when we talk about a model to decide what is it meant to describe and what it does not try to describe. Now, the reason we make models is also to make better predictions about things. In a sense, and especially in computer science, we create a model that we sort of put in the computer so that we can run the model and say things about the physical world that is being modeled without having to test it in the real world. So we can run simulations, for example. And the predictive power is, you know, something that helps me to make predictions. Now, in physics, for example, a lot of these predictions are can be done by applying mathematic formulas, because the world can be modeled in mathematical equations. But we'll see other predictive models that are not using this type of modeling, which is the one that usually computer scientists are more familiar with. So descriptive, predictive. The third level is what we call generative. And I think that's really what we are after when we create models for interaction in general. We're trying to have a model that helps us create new solutions to a problem we have identified. So I talked about pointing quite a bit. There is an underlying model there based on Fitts' law. This model is predictive. In that case, it uses a formula, which is why it's an easy one to talk about. With a formula of movement time, it equals a linear combination of the index of difficulty. I can predict the time it should take a user to point at a target, only knowing the size and distance to the target. So it's a predictive model in that sense. Now, any predictive model, you'll have to confront to reality. I mean, is it doing predictions that are good enough, accurate enough? And since we're dealing with human behavior, it's not like measuring the time it takes for something to fall on the floor, which, you know, is going to be very stable. When you deal with human behavior, you can have quite a lot of variability. And so the models cannot be as precise in that sense. But getting back to the generative aspect, we saw how having this Fitts' law for pointing helped us think about how can we make pointing more efficient. And we saw that Fitts' law was depending on the D over W ratio. And so if we want to make movement time shorter, well, we should try to reduce distance or increase width. And we saw different techniques to do that. So this is what we mean by generative. And it's I want to emphasize that oftentimes it is misunderstood, because generative, some people think there is something automatic there, that you know, you plug your model into some system and then it's going to spit out solutions. This is not what we mean by generative. It's helping us humans create new solutions. And then the model can help simulate them and test them in advance, but the generative aspect is in your head. It's your brain that does it. It's not the computer. Now, I emphasize the three levels for models that are used in general in engineering, I would say. If you're doing astrophysics, or if you only studying the real world, if you're not in the business of building new things, if you're observing the real world, you want models that are descriptive. You want models that are predictive. But instead of models that are generative, you are looking for things that allow you to control and better understand the phenomenon. And that's where we're going to get to theories. Now, there are things that are tools to help describe models, and we tend to call them notations. And the idea of a notation is that it's not as formal as a model. It can be informal, it can be complete, it can be inconsistent. We'll see one example called the user action notation, which is something useful to describe things. So it helps at the descriptive level, but it's not necessarily meant to be a model in and by itself. It's not meant to be predictive, for example. Yes? So far, so good. So what is a theory now? So a model is not a theory, and a theory does not necessarily rely on a model, even though, again, in especially in France, the country of Descartes. You guys know Descartes? Philosopher? Yeah, well, you heard of him. That's the word Cartesian comes from, Descartes, right? So, you know, when you say you're Cartesian, you're very, like, everything can be done with math. It's the way it's usually understood. So we tend to think of theory as something that has equations, and you like to see, you know, pictures of this physicist with their blackboard covered with equations with weird Greek letters and all that. But theory does not have to be a mathematical theory. So, yes?
I'm unable to imagine model in a computer field. How can I imagine real world model?
Well, in general, when you do things with computers, it's related to the real world.
Yes.
So,
what will be a model in
field? Well, if you are, if I take a common example, you're trying to build a system for a company to do its accounting. Well, but you have customers, you have accounts, you have invoices, you have, and so you have these things in the real world that used to be done on pieces of paper, and the model is you're going to turn that into UML or whatever description of the digital things that are going to represent these different objects and activities. So that's a model, right? But it's a model that is here only done to replicate or run. It's not a model where you're trying to do necessarily prediction. Although there are tools that say, well, you know, you can test properties of a system, for example. That would be some aspect of being predictive, where you try to figure out if your system is going to be able to handle, if you're doing a web server and you want to have an estimate on how many connections it can handle simultaneously, well, you can run the test for real, or you can also try in advance to make some calculation to see if it's working. So that's going to be based on the model of what time it takes to handle a request and how things get distributed. So this is what we call models in computer science. It's these abstractions over the program or the system itself that help us to design it to test it. So a theory, the big difference between a model and a theory is that the theory is trying to be explanatory. It's trying to explain reality so we can understand it. A model is descriptive. So if you take Fitt's law, it doesn't explain anything. So it's a good model because it's proven to be quite reliable. It works. But it doesn't tell you why it is that, you know, you have this relationship. So Fitt's law is not a theory. The theory that is behind Fitt's law, if there is any, would be the theory, for example, from information theory, which I talked a little bit about, because this formula actually can be compared with a basic formula of information theory. And the underlying theory is, well, the human is communicating information to the outside world by saying, I want to go towards that target instead of that target. And so by this analogy, we have some kind of explanation. But it's not a full explanation by any means. It's a pretty high-level one, making assumptions about this communication model. A more detailed theory would be to be the theory of how the signals, what's happening in our brain, what signals go through our muscles to control our movement and things like this. And that would be a theory, and there are several theories of how we control movement with various hypotheses on how there's feedback loop between the vision system and the motor system, and then it becomes quite complex. So theories and model very often work hand in hand. You base your theory, or your theory includes a model, but it's trying to explain reality, and it raises the issue of validity. So with a model and with a predictive model, testing validity is simple enough. It makes predictions. You can compare these predictions with the real world. And if it matches, you say, well, it's a good model. But it can make good predictions without explaining how things work in the real world. It can be a good simulation of the real world, even though it's working very differently. In fact, if you think of all the hype around machine learning, right? So we have all these machine learning systems that perform as well or better than humans. So it's tempting to say, and in fact, the word machine learning or neural network make it think, make a lot of people, you know, believe that the computer is really working like a human brain, which it's not at all. There's some vague analogy, but it's not at all. So we have a model that is very powerful because, yes, it can recognize images and be as good or better as a human for a certain number of tasks. But the theory that it is working like a human brain is certainly not proven. In fact, it's certainly disproven. So there is the issue of validity of the predictions, which is the easy part, but there is the validity of the theory itself. Is it really the way it works? And then we go into philosophical and epistemological questions of what does it mean to explain something and to understand something, and I'm not going to go there. But there's a very important meta-theory, if I could say so, that was introduced by Popper to say, well, you know, we need to have, in science, we like to have methods and to agree about how we go about making progress. And so Popper introduced this notion that a scientific theory has to be expressed in a way that it can be disproved through experiments. So if you come up with a theory of relativity, you should also come up with experiments or devices or things that makes, for example, a prediction so that if then the actual measurement is different from the prediction, it would say, well, my theory is false. And so if you think of, physics and Newtonian mechanics, I'll get it, so the classic mechanics, and then relativity. So classic mechanics was doing some prediction, like how long it takes for something to get to the floor when I drop it. And when relativity was introduced, they say, well, you know, there are conditions, situations, where these predictions done by classical mechanics are not going to work. So we're going to disprove classical mechanics, and we'll show that our theory, relativity, is more accurate. So the trick with that is you can never prove a theory to be correct, which is kind of frustrating, right? Because there's always the possibility that someone will come up with a new idea to disprove your theory. And you cannot, you know, go over all the things that could disprove your theory, so you never know. So you test and test and test, and your theory gets stronger and stronger as it, you know, passes this test. But maybe someday there will be an even bigger thing than relativity that will show that in certain circumstances it's not good enough. And since this is all linked to, especially in fields like physics, linked to measurements, you know, finding the difference between classical mechanics and relativistic mechanics is not easy. I mean, you need to have things that approach the speed of light and all that, so it's not something we experience in everyday life, even though, you know, even when an object drops on the floor, the laws of relativity apply. They're just so small in effect that we can't even measure it. So the bar to create a theory is quite high, and this is all nice and well when we're theories that are based on mathematical models, like in the case of classical mechanics or relativistic mechanics, where you have these equations and you can say, well, I predict the time to be this, and then I can measure it. But theories are not always based on this kind of mathematical models. So if you look at theories of the mind, of how the brain works, cognitive science in general, you won't find equations in those papers. You'll find models that say, well, you know, there's this part of the brain that does this, and this other part does that, and here's what happens when you do problem solving. And then you bring evidence from things like doing MRI scans. So you put someone in an MRI machine, and you look at what lights up in the brain as you ask the person to do this task versus that task, and you say, oh, see, this thing lights up in this condition, it doesn't in that condition, so it means that. This is also the types of models and the type of theories that we deal with. My emphasis here is that it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily boil down to equations and what people call hard science. And coming from an engineering background and discovering psychology and all that, like many other colleagues have done this transition as well, we realize that, you know, soft sciences, as they call it, are a lot more difficult than hard science. Because when you put things into equations, it's kind of easy. You run the equations, you run the simulations, you run the experiment, you get numbers, you compare, it works. When you have soft sciences, what's called soft, where the models are too complex to be turned into equations, because that's really what it's all about, well, you need other methods, and things are never as clear-cut. So if you are in the medical field and you test a new drug, for example, you're not going to simulate the effect of the drug to predict how it works. There are too many parameters and variables from individual to individual. So you run this large test and you try to draw conclusions from that, and you do complex statistics because the effects are usually quite small. So it's a whole different type of methods than the one that as engineers and people who train in math and physics are used to. And it takes time to realize that soft science is, in fact, harder than hard science. Anyway, end of rant. Now, there are things that are not theories because they don't represent an understanding of reality, but they observe a regularity and they just work. So this is usually what we call Fitts' law. It's an empirical law. It had an idea. Even though this idea was inspired by information theory, the link with information theory is kind of loose. And it certainly has not been proven that our motor control system looks and works like an information theory model of communication. So he was inspired by this, did his experiment, and he observed that it worked. But Fitts' law, it's called a law, it's not Fitts' theory, it's Fitts' law because it's just an empirical observation that just works. There's probably a theory behind it, we just haven't really, or there are several of them, that are in competition at the moment. Be that as it may, it's useful when you are in the business of designing things. Because if it works, you can probably do something with it. If we knew the underlying theory, it's probably even better. But if it works, it's already a good start. Okay, so I don't know if this has clarified things. It's a complex topic, and I find it. Has anybody in this class had a course on epistemology? on scientific methods. Yes? Yeah, I know in... you were in Aalto, right? You were in Finland?
No.
No, where?
I'm from Oslo.
Oslo, Norway. Oh, sorry. Well, I was going to talk about Sweden, in fact, because at KTH, which is the place where the EIT HCID program has a class. So in Sweden at KTH, I know they have a mandatory class scientific methods. And so I'm not surprised there's one in Norway, and I know they do that also in Denmark. So they do that in Scandinavian countries, but in the country of Descartes, I don't know, I guess they assume that, you know, we're born with it or something. but it's kind of sad that there is no class in the topic. So you said you took one?
Yeah, but during high school, I studied philosophy. So Popper,
yeah.
Communism, stuff.
Okay, so you did that in high school?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. In my philosophy class in high school, we had a choice between Freud and Marx. I would have preferred Popper. What? Well, the class had to choose. I don't even remember what we did.
Both are not scientific. So Both are empirical. They are not scientific.
Yeah. And anyway, I won't go into into that. Okay, so my point here is to show you a few of the things that exist out there. It targets two types of students. Some of you, I hope, will want to continue in doing research. So it sort of gives you an idea of the kind of theoretical background and theoretical topics that can be studied in HCI or on which you build on when we create HCI theories and models. But for those of you who will go into industry and become practitioners and will change the world, I hope for us, it also gives you an idea of the fact that there are sort of deeper things behind all the practical things that you end up using when you design systems in the real world. So I will start with perception and action. There are some things we've talked about a little bit already, and some we haven't. So I'll start with perception, because, you know, it all starts there, in a sense. Perception. There are, as I've said when I was doing the short, you know, intro on psychology, sight has been studied intensively. Vision has been studied intensively. One aspect of the study of vision is that we have observed that humans can recognize visual features, some features, very rapidly. And there's a list of them here that have been tested formally and for which we know that if you have lines in different orientations, or if you have blobs of different sizes, or things of different length, or thickness, or curvature, or different numbers of objects, etc., we can perceive those in a flash. And so Treisman came up with this theory that's called pre-attentive perception. The idea that you can perceive things before you even try to draw your attention to it. And the question is, how is that possible? For example, I can show you a very rapid series of images. And if there is the image of, say, your mother in there, you will immediately recognize it, even though it flashed for 20 milliseconds. So there are things that are going on in the brain that, you know, have to go so fast that they cannot involve the complex processing that we can imagine that we may do for some other visual tasks. So there's parallel handling at the level of visual perception. Things have to happen in parallel to explain that we're able to do these things. And when we're not able to perceive something in a pre-attentive way, so before you sort of look at it for real, in a sense, these then must be handled sequentially, which, of course, is a lot slower. This is linked with a theory that came out in the, I guess, in the 19th century, of Gestalt theory of sort of global perception, which I'll get to in a second. Now we're going to do a little illustration of this. Are you ready? What do you see? Something? No? Okay, good. Otherwise it would be. Now, what did you see? Dots. Anything special about these dots?
Different forms.
Horizontal and vertical. Yes.
Different directions.
Hmm?
Dots in different directions.
Different directions. How many directions?
Clusters.
How many directions? Two. So they were like horizontal and vertical. How many of each?
One and the other.
So one was different from the others? Yes?
I think few are different.
Few?
Few are horizontal and most of them vertical.
Okay, few and more. You say one, they say few and more. Yes?
One was like a little squished in, I think.
Yes? Well, that's what they call direction. One was squished horizontally and the others were.
Even more so, I think.
Ah, complicated. So, let's see. I don't know that I can show it to you, actually. Here it was again. So, well, I'm going to do it again. Now, I want to know how many are squished horizontally, how many are squished vertically. Okay. Maybe you should see your eye doctors, because normally you're supposed to perceive the fact there's only one that has a different orientation than the others. That's pre-attentive perception. In a fraction of a second, I think I don't remember if I put 100 milliseconds or whatever, you could perceive that there was one, so you won, one in a different orientation as the others. Exercise number two, open your eyes.
Hmm?
What? So two different colors. Intensity, okay. So black and gray, yes?
Somewhere horizontal, somewhere vertical.
Okay, and how many? Too hard. We only have two eyes. So usually I can show the, I guess I have to get out of the mode here. So this was the first one. So indeed, there is only one horizontal, and they're all vertical. And the point here, there is only one feature that changes, which is orientation. And I'm sorry, they're all squished the same. So that was the first one. And the second one here, well, there are two features that change. So horizontal, vertical, and as you said, color or intensity. And also there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are 6 that are horizontal.
Is it the same form of the vertical?
I don't know. Not, maybe not. Although I don't know what the distortion of the screen is doing to this. Because I think I took one and rotated it 90 degrees, so. So the point here is, going back to this one, if you have one feature that changes, you can perceive it. And if there are only one or two that are different, you are able even to know that there is only one or two. But if there is more, if I had put half and half in two orientations, of course you wouldn't be able to count, but you still would have seen the two variations. Now, if I combine two features, well, maybe you can perceive that there are two features that are varied, but you wouldn't be able to say that, for example, only the gray ones are horizontal and verticals, and I could have put all the black ones all vertical, for example, and that you wouldn't have been able to perceive because that's too much parallel processing at the same time. And so once you cannot perceive pre-attentively, then you have to go and scan and go linearly to observe the difference. Now, of course, this is useful in user interface design because it's interesting in especially in things like games or critical software, if you put in alarms and things like this to know what is likely to be perceived. So I said this was sort of a theory derived from the principles of Gestalt perception. And here, again, I don't use the word theory. Even though there is something called Gestalt theory, to me, it doesn't really follow the definition of theory that I gave before. But psychologists I think it was in the late 1800, identified this notion that we can perceive global characteristics of pictures very quickly. And they made this classification where if things are grouped together, so someone mentioned that some dots were clustered in the first image. I was trying hard to not have them clustered. but of course, it's impossible to do it completely. But if an area had been more clustered than another, you would have perceived that very directly. Another one is proximity. When two things are close to each other, you sort of cluster them together, you assemble them. And so if I want this to be the label of that object, I can put it close to it, and that's enough. I don't need additional visual information. If it's getting a bit far away, I can add a little line, and I create what they call connectivity. And so when you have these lines, it connects things. And again, it's something you sort of can perceive pre-attentively, so it's very effective. A lot of the knowledge of graphic designers, which is typically empirical knowledge, is based on these kind of things. Now, there are other principles in Gestalt perception, which is the perception of alignments. And again, if you remember the image I flashed, the dots were not aligned. I tried to, randomize them. Because if you align things, you immediately see alignments. So here, I have equal spacing between all the dots. So it's more seeing them like a common area, a blob of things. But if I make the spacing, the vertical spacing a bit larger, you perceive horizontal lines, right? And if I do the, I don't know, the one on the right is not as convincing because the difference is smaller, but it's also showing some vertical lines. So just by playing with this visual layout, you can communicate relationships. And the last example here, is that we are very good at perceiving symmetry. So what's the difference between those two graphs, apart from their layout? I'm sorry, it's not?
One is a polygon, the other one is not.
Yeah, but apart from the shape,
yeah,
the structure of the graph.
If you cut it in half, then it's kind of a mirror effect.
Yes.
The other one does not have the same.
So the one on the right, you see the symmetry. The one on the left, you don't. Yes?
I would say on the one on the right, it's easier to go from 1 to 6, while the one on the left, it's a little more difficult.
Yeah. But as graphs, are they the same or are they different? Yeah. So did you see that? No. Right. So they have the same structure. One is connected to 3 and to 2. One is connected to 3 and to 2. 2 goes to 4 and has arrows from 1 and 5. 2 goes to 4 and then arrows from 1 and 5, etc. So it's the same graph. So I just move the things to get this layout. So just by changing this layout, you can make some properties more visible, like here, the symmetry. So these principles, again, are used in visual design a lot and are very effective. We only have a partial understanding of how we perceive these things so efficiently. We know that we have neurons in the brain that do detect things like lines and orientations, so are very specialized for detecting particular shapes. When it comes to more global patterns, well, I don't know the latest in the vision research, but it's something that is not fully understood. So a second theory I want to talk about, I already mentioned before, is Gibson's ecological theory of perception. And I would call that a theory because he calls it a theory. But he has a... So Gibson in the world of HCI is mostly known for the notion of affordances that we talked about before. But the bulk of his research has been on perception, and in particular visual perception, at the more, I would say, basic and lower level than the notion of affordance, which is sort of a high-level notion. So his theory is based on a hypothesis of how organisms on Earth have evolved and have co-evolved with their environment. So organisms have evolved according to Darwinian evolution, but it's more complex than just survival of the fittest. But also they have changed the environment. And so this is what it is calling coevolution. And for example, our perception senses, the fact that the eyes, if you take all the animals on Earth that have eyes, they all see in about the same very small spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum, between, 500 and 700 nanometers or something like this. This is super narrow. We don't have animals that see X-rays or gamma rays or things like this. Some animals can have a better hearing than we do, can hear ultrasound, especially the dogs, which is a good way to annoy them without annoying humans. But it's interesting that all animals perceive visually in the same very narrow part of the spectrum. And probably it's because that's where there's interesting things to see. And yes, when we see pictures shot with an infrared camera, for example, that shows you heat, well, it has interesting information, but it's not as rich as what we see in what we call the visible spectrum. So coevolution, a second thing is this behavioral pre-adaptation, which I don't want to get into. What I like about this is this notion of elegant perceptual processes. It's based on the idea that, when you have competition between different ways of doing something, the one that usually tend to win is the one that is the most, what he calls parsimonious, that requires the least resources. The least energy, for example, and is more elegant, is more simple. And in many sciences, you know, they're saying that, you know, if you have multiple explanation, it's the simpler one that is likely to be the right one. Not always, but it's a general sort of rule. So Gibson worked a lot on what it is we perceive. And he was fighting the idea that we have a little guy in the brain with a little camera and analyzing these images. And instead, he was trying to think of what it is there is to perceive and what it is there is to perceive so we can act in efficient ways. And so his take is that there is information, and I find it interesting he's using the word information in that case. There's information in what he called the optical array, which is, you know, the way the world is perceived by a retina, which you should not think of as snapping a picture with your smartphone. So the optical array and the optical flow, the fact that what we perceive is change, not state. And I said before that our eyes are moving all the time. They do these micro movements. And if they did not move all the time, we would not see, right? That's because what we perceive is change. And so he's been looking at what kind of changes inform us about what's going on in the world. And so I talked about this invariant, that when you move in a space, the optical flow, if you look at each point, you see how it changes from one picture, from one perception to the next. So this flow, which is depicted here by these little arrows, the only fixed point is the one in the direction you're going to. And so there is evidence that, yes, in our brain there are neurons that are specialized to perceive this kind of invariance. So it's parsimonious because you don't need to make complex calculation. Just extracting the invariant will tell you where you're going at any one time. Another example that I think I've cited before is that if I throw a ball at you, you are going to run to catch the ball. And the way to make sure you can catch the ball if you run fast enough is to maintain a constant angle between the motion of the ball and your own motion. And if you maintain this invariant, you will catch the ball. And if you throw a ball at a dog, this is exactly the trajectory the dog is following. So it's a powerful theory, first because it addresses some, you know, high-level visual behavior. A lot of vision science has looked at, well, how small objects can we see with our eyes, how, you know, all the sort of very individual properties by slicing and dicing the aspect of visual perception, is taking a much, much more global approach, and yet can come up with a theory that in his book, for which this is the cover, he talks about the number of experiments that he has run to support his theory. So I think this is a very interesting book to read to just get a different perspective and get out of this notion that our brain is a little computer for perception as well as for other things. So then, having sort of built the sort of ground level theory on visual perception based on extracting invariants and stuff like that, then he talks about higher level stuff like action perception coupling, the fact that we need to, in order to act, we need to perceive, and in order to perceive, we need to act. And then goes to the notion of affordance, which is the fact that since, you know, we need to perceive the world in order to act in the world, but then we need to perceive the capability for action that are in the world. And that's sort of this loop in there, and that's where the notion of affordance comes from, the fact that the world offers capabilities for action, and he's shown experiments to not to prove, because of course you can only disprove, you cannot prove, but to show evidence that we immediately perceive in certain cases, for example, the ability to go through an opening in a wall, we perceive if it's big enough for us to go through, and that's an example of direct perception linked to an affordance. Having said that, and even though affordances have been translated in the world of HCI, as I've said before, by Don Norman, and are a useful concept, a lot of people misunderstand it and try to operationalize affordances, saying, well, I'm going to put an affordance there. No, you don't put affordances there. You don't get to decide. The users will decide. So it's a useful intellectual tool, probably, for designers, but you have to be careful to not also sort of make it do more things than what it's been meant to be. So that's about perception. Of course, there's a lot more literature about perception in general, which is very important for people who are doing things like visual analytics and how to create visual visualization. So there's an entire elective on information visualization. And it's important to understand how we perceive things so as to make visualization that don't lie to the users, for example. And so there's a lot more, but Trisman and Gibson are typically ones that are very often referred to in this field. Okay, then we have Hick's law and Fitt's law. So Fitt's law we talked about. I haven't talked about Hick's law, have I? No. Okay, so again, these are empirical laws. They're not theories. And they can be useful in design of interactive systems. The first one, which I haven't talked about so far, is called Hick's law, or Hick and Hyman, H-Y-M-A-N. Hick and Hyman law. So it turns out that since I did this slide, which is now a few years old, very recently a student of mine conducted an in-depth study of Hick's law and to understand what was the original work, because we build on work in psychology and other fields, and sometimes misunderstanding or misinterpretations build up, and we build on the shoulders of giants, but sometimes things get lost in translation, if I may say so. So Hick's law, Hick and Hyman separately, were studying what is called choice reaction time. Their original type of experiment was you have an array of lights, light bulbs, that could be laid out in a circle, for example. And then you have something like, say, a keyboard, piano-like keyboard, not computer keyboard. And through training, you have to learn that if a certain light lights up, you have to push a certain key on the keyboard. And what they call the choice reaction time is the time it takes between the bulb lighting up and you pushing the right button. And what they found is that the reaction time, it's called RT, is proportional to the logarithm of the number of choices, of the number of lights. With, as usual, A and B being constant, which you can adjust according to the particular subject, the particular design, etc. Now, Hick's law you'll find in online blogs, in even textbooks, in the literature on design of user interfaces, UX, as being used to support some design rules, such as when you have lots of choices, you should divide them in categories and make a series of choices rather than one choice in one large set. This is the rule that says that, you know, if you have a menu system, it's better to do submenus than big, long menus. It turns out that this is probably a good design rule, but it is not due to Hick's law. Because in fact, if you do the math, and we have a paper in submission about this, if we do the math, you apply this to one big set or to multiple choices in that set being cut into one first level and then a second level, well, the reaction time, the overall reaction time will be longer than in one big set. So in fact, Hick's law tells you, put everything together if you can. But that is due to a misunderstanding of what Hick's law is measuring. For a lot of the interpretation that I have percolated in HCI and in UX, user experience books and all that, is it's the time it takes to make a choice. But it's called choice reaction time, but it's not the time really it takes to make a choice in like thinking about, oh, is that the right menu item, or is that the right icon, or is that the right whatever. It's really the time it takes for you to react when you are highly trained. When Hick, I don't remember which one of Hick and Hyman now, but their first experiment, they trained themselves, they did experiments on themselves at first, like for 5,000 trials before measuring performance. So they had learned this mapping from the light bulb to the right key, you know, over and over again to react as fast as possible. And they were just interested in this reaction time. In interfaces, what we've shown, what we found is that this reaction time can be considered pretty much constant for various reasons. And in any case, it's so small that it doesn't really make a big difference. So this is a case where the work done by Hick and Hyman and others in psychology is very interesting and important. The way it's been applied to HCI, we found, was probably not justified. Now, I don't know if it's better that to use a theory in the wrong way to justify design principles that are, in fact, correct? Is that worse than if you use a law correctly to support design guidelines that, in fact, are not good? I'm not sure which one is worse. But it's a very interesting. So there, well, I hope this paper will get out and I will make it available. Because it's interesting to it's a little bit the same thing with Gibson and affordances, is that psychology is often perceived, again, as a soft science. So, you know, you take something, and because it's described in words rather than equations, you don't need to really read the details and understand it all deeply. You just, you know, pick up something and then translate it and say, well, this is affordances, this is this is choice reaction time, and mislead an entire community. But psychology is a very serious field, and as rigorous as physics or any other fields. It's just using different methods because the thing it's studying are not amenable to, in general, to mathematical description. But the fact that it's not mathematical does not mean that it's not rigorous, and we should really be careful to look at all the details of this thing that comes out of psychology before deciding how it applies and if it applies to HCI. And indeed, you know, Hick's law, even though it's cited and used once in a while, hasn't had near as much the same impact as Fitts' law, which is really widely known and used in HCI. Which is a good thing, because the way Fitts' law is used is in general I would say, correct. And so I've talked about it at length, so I'm not going to go back to it very much. We have this movement time proportional to the index of difficulty. And it was inspired by analogy with information theory. If you're interested in that, our group has also published several papers on making this link more formal and more strict, solving a number of issues that were in the application of Fitts' law. But this is mostly, I would say, work of a theoretical nature that does not have direct impact, at least yet, on HCI design. The thing about these two laws is they also model expert behavior. So in the first one, I said, you know, they train themselves to have this, to learn this mapping and be as efficient as possible. Fitts' law, you ask people to point as fast as they can, which is not necessarily what happens in the real world. And so when you apply this type of law, you have to be aware of their domain of validity and whether they are relevant in actual use. And I think I showed that last time with a various example. Now, kinematic chain theory. So that's a theory due to Yves Guillard, a French psychologist. And it's been looking at how we use our two hands in everyday tasks. Again, a little bit like Gibson was challenging some theories in vision, this is challenging some theories on your left hand, if you're right-handed, is a bad version of your right hand. It's less fast, it's less precise, it's less good at things. So if you've broken your right hand and had to do things only with your left hand, like writing and stuff, it's like painful. But when you observe people using their two hands in everyday tasks, what he observed is that the two hands had different roles. And the hand and the arm is an articulated body, right? So with your shoulder, you have a large amplitude, but not much precision. And then when you get to your fingers, you have small amplitude, but high precision. So we call this the kinematic chain, going from the shoulder to the elbow, to the wrist, to the finger knuckles. And it combines amplitude and precision. Now, his key finding was to, or the key to his theory, is that, I'm going to say the left arm, so the non-dominant hand, to be politically correct, so the left arm for right-handed people and vice versa, is not symmetric to the dominant hand, but it's rather higher levels up the kinematic chain. Because when you observe people doing things with two hands in many, many tasks, the non-dominant hand acts first. Like if you take a piece of paper, you're going to use your left arm to put it in front of you and put it in the place where your right hand is going to then write in the place that is the most efficient for it. And your left hand, as you write, will move, I mentioned that before, will move the sheet of paper so you write in the most comfortable place. And if you cannot use your left hand and have to write on a fixed sheet of paper, you're going to be less efficient, less fast, because you don't have this additional distal control on the context of the task. The fact that the non-dominant hand controls the context means that it does not have to be precise. So it's not that it's not precise to start with, it's that it does not have to be, so we don't develop that skill. You know, we're economical beings. The dominant hand exerts what we call proximal control, proximal meaning close to the end of the chain and to the real action. So it acts after the non-dominant hand in the frame of reference established by the non-dominant hand, and it usually requires more precise movements. Now, he had done studies, you know, if the way, for example, you sweep the floor and you hold the broom, there's one hand that is used as the to pivot the broom and to put it in the right place, and then the other hand is going to, in fact, do finer control if you go into corners and things like this. If you put toothpaste on your toothbrush, you know, which hands are you using for what? It's interesting. Because you're usually going to take the brush with your non-dominant hand, put toothpaste with your dominant hand because you need a precise thing to squish the toothpaste. And then you're going to change hand because to brush your teeth, you want precision, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we, interestingly, this has been discovered by Bill Buxton and colleagues when they were creating this interface called Tool Glasses at Xerox PARC, with the idea that and I showed a video of that, remember Tool Glasses, where you move a palette with your left hand, a non-dominant hand with a trackball, and then you click through. And so they had invented this interface, and they thought it was very efficient because, you know, it mimicked the way we use a ruler to draw lines with two hands and stuff like that. But they were not aware of Yves Geer's theory, and they discovered it one way, and they were very happy because it was a theory that was supported their interface design and explained why it was efficient in a sense, to the point that Bill Buxton actually flew to Marseille where Yves Guillard was doing his research and tell him, I'm going to make you famous. Which I guess happened because Yves is now very well known in the HCI field. And I had a chance to work and still work with him, and he's a great guy to work with. Now, we did work on bimanual interaction, and we did this experiment where the task was to move a rectangle to match the position and size of another rectangle. So you see the thing? So essentially, you have your two hands available to create a rectangle of a precise size and position. And so we did two mappings of your hand movements to the rectangle. One where each hand holds a corner of the rectangle, right? Now, this is called a symmetric assignment because the two hands have the same role. So it goes counter to the kinematic chain. The kinematic chain, we said, well, you're going to use one hand to position the rectangle and the other one just to adjust the size. And we ran an experiment, and we were hoping that the asymmetric assignment, the second one, would win being meaning being faster and more precise, and it didn't. So maybe this is a falsification. We showed an example where, well, the kinematic chain theory does not apply. However, upon reflection, this is not quite that yet, because remember that here, the non-dominant hand acts first, so it makes sense that you're going to move the rectangle first close to where you want it and then adjust the size. But to adjust the size and match the exact position, your left hand, again, non-dominant hand, will have to be as precise as the other to get to the exact position. And so, in a sense, it was not following that, the principle that you don't need as much precision with the non-dominant hand as with the dominant one. But it's good to know that there are tasks where symmetric assignment will perform better than the asymmetric, some asymmetric ones. Okay. So now we're moving towards another set of theories. around cognition and behavior. So sort of we've done perception and action. Now we're moving to cognition and behavior. I'll start with one we've talked about before. So action theory, which to me is not a theory because I don't know how to falsify it. In fact, I was trying to look at that up the other day because I don't think that Norman really called it action theory. I mean, it's known as the seven stages of action, and people have used the word action theory, but I don't know if this is the term he has used. Now, as a quick reminder, action theory says that you have a goal in mind, and you want to get the system in a state that matches that goal. And so, cognitively speaking, you first form the intention that you want to reach that goal, then you specify the action to reach that goal, and then you execute those action by inputting stuff. The reason why this is famous and useful in HCI is because it distinguishes these two distances. Sorry. What's called the input cognitive distance and the input articulatory distance. So the first one is going from the abstract goal in my head to a set of actions to reach that goal. And the second one is going from having this set of steps in my head and turning them into actual physical actions onto the system. So we call that the execution distance. And the idea is that when you design an interface, you can try to think of whether it is better at reducing that distance or the other. And Norman talks about the gulf of execution and the gulf on the other side of evaluation. So it's kind of a measure of this distance, but you know, it's not the distance you're going to measure in inches or centimeters. It's the idea that typically in direct manipulation interfaces, the articulatory distance is shorter because if you think, well, I need to trash that object, the execution step is grab the object and put it to the trash. Whereas in a command line interface, you would have to think, oh, I need to delete this object, so the command, no, it's not delete, it's actually rm for remove, so I need to type rm, and then I need to know the name of the file. So it's more work to go from, I want to delete this file, to actually deleting it. And you have the same, well, the same, the symmetrical arrangement on the other side, where once the system has performed the actions you have put into it, you have to perceive the change in the system state to understand what really happened. And that's what is called the output articulatory distance. And then once you have seen what has changed, you have to interpret it and compare it to your original goal. And that's called the output cognitive distance. And so here again, in interface design, you can think of these different steps and see what can be made easier. So if you type the command rm something and then you get the prompt, you know, you get very little in terms of perception. So it's easy to perceive because essentially nothing happened. But it's hard to interpret because you have to interpret as, well, it didn't complain, so it went well, so my file is gone. And as I've said before, even though people, even trained experts, at the command line, after they remove something, they will instinctively type ls to make sure it's gone, even though they know. In a direct manipulation interface, well, you will see that the icon is gone, so you don't have to, you know, convince yourself that it's not there anymore. Interestingly, you know it's gone, but you also know it's not gone because it's in the trash, so you can take it back. It's well, you can get at it by measuring time, but it's not the only measure. It can be the number of actions you have to make. You know, that's why there's no, it's called distance, but there's no official unit to measure it. But certainly, you know, in the vast majority of HCI research or practice that tries to measure performance is using the measures of time and error. Because it's one thing if you can do something faster, but if you make more errors, it may not be a win in the end. And so there is this, what in Fitts' law is called the Fitts accuracy trade-off, but that we saw in many tasks. Speed, can I do it faster? Accuracy, can I make fewer errors? And so the speed accuracy trade-off says that usually when you find a way to do things faster, there is a risk that it's going to also create more errors. And then you have to factor in the cost of repairing errors, which in the end may mean that the faster technique will not be as efficient. Okay. Now, this model of action theory is very... well, it's very Cartesian. It's like, I have a goal, I specify my action, I execute the action, I see what happens. I'm happy, I move on to the next goal. Or I'm not happy, I repair. So it looks like, you know, everything is planned and done sort of according to plan. In practice, things are more complicated in the real world. And so next time, since I see a little social pressure there, next time, tomorrow, teaser for tomorrow, situated action, Lucy Suchman, which brought an ethnographic approach, an anthropological? Well, she's an anthropologist. So Suchman versus Norman, the anthropologist versus the cognitivist. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Okay, any question? Yes?
Do we have classes next week? Because a lot of courses don't have classes, so it's not very clear which one we have on.
Yes, and I'm going to ask Raphael to come in.
Hello.
So originally, since I'm not here, I'm going to a conference. Since there is the, you guys have the M1 HCID, have the kickoff. Where are you guys going this year?
Trento,
Italy, yes. So they're asking if there is class tomorrow. There is class tomorrow. Next week.
So no one applied.
Okay.
Class. So you are exempted from HCI class, either TA or classes next week.
Both Wednesday and Thursday.
On the site, it said that for the exam, we're allowed a double-sided sheet full of R notes, is that correct?
Yes. So I'll say that again for everyone. For the exam, the only document that is allowed or device, the only thing you can bring is an A4 sheet of paper. Yes. Well, if it's US letter, it's okay. If it's smaller, it's okay. If it's bigger, it's not okay. With your own handwriting on it. You can cover it with whatever you want, or bring a blank sheet if you want. For us to entertain ourselves while you are working, because you won't need it, but it makes you more comfortable.
And try not to do photocopy of someone else's handwriting also.